Hello, everyone. Here we are again, seven revolutions later, on the left side of the Great Divide, balancing into another Express Yourself. I'm Luke Nestler. Well, that was the Mountain Madrigals, recorded in December of 2014. The Mountain Madrigals have a new show. It's called Ring In Christmas, and they will start their holiday performances this coming Sunday at 2:30 p.m. at the United Methodist Church in Glenwood Springs. The concert is free, donations are accepted, and child care is provided. Look for two shows next weekend, and then the last one on the weekend of December 17th. Well, Katie and Kay's Labor of Love auction starts in about an hour over at the Village Smithy, and I caught up with Bodie Stanberry, auction coordinator, yesterday. She wasn't breathless, but she was busy. However, she took some time to tell me about some of the cool things that we can find at the auction. Bodie Stanberry joins the show. Bodie is the auction coordinator for this year's Labor of Love auction. Welcome, Bodie.
Hi, Luke.
I'm all excited about this one.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a really good one.
Yeah, I think so too. Over at the Village Smithy, starting in about an hour.
Mm-hmm.
Should be fun. And you know, we couldn't pull it off with the folks without the folks at the Smithy, as well as our major sponsors, Alpine Bank and American National Bank.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you, thank you. I'm so excited to have this auction at the Smithy. I think it's going to be such a good time.
A lot more intimate than that cavernous rec center over there.
Yeah, that's definitely what we were aiming for.
Yeah.
Make some stops along your way. Come stop by the auction. Go to the Clay Center. There's so much going on tonight.
Yes, there is. But please include us on your circuit. And the reason, because you can pretty much fulfill all of your holiday shopping needs. Tick all those items off your list at the Katie and Kay auction, and it helps your community radio station. What are you all excited about this year as far as what we're auctioning off, Bodie?
I am really excited about the Hot Springs Pool Pass. I definitely think that I am going to put something in for that.
Nice.
There's a lot of really amazing local art and pottery that we've gotten. Really great stuff.
Some bigger items, too. Isn't there a vacation home somewhere?
Yeah, in San Miguel de Allende,
wow.
We have a house that has three bedrooms and two bathrooms for an entire week in El Centro in San Miguel. And I used to live down there. It's an amazing city.
Is that a mountain town?
No. Not, I mean, well,
Is it I'm not sure.
I don't know. I always hung out downtown and I was a teenager. So I know that there were mountains around there, but I'm not.
Definitely not the authority. Old colonial town, too.
Yeah, it is.
Wow.
Yeah.
So probably pretty cool architecture and some culture, too.
Yeah, it's beautiful. And all their events are just amazing. And they have mariachi bands wandering around every night. It's a really beautiful town.
Yeah, well, thanks to Mike Lousy, the Pitkin County Commissioner, for donating that week in his hacienda in San Miguel de Allende.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, that's going to be so cool. Any other big items that look pretty pretty great?
Yeah, I mean, we have Avs tickets. We have 4 Avs tickets, amazing seats. It's a game with the San Jose Sharks. I forget exactly what day it is. Really great tickets with a parking pass.
Also, we have Scott Levine to tell us about a really cool item up for grabs. Joining the program now is El Capitan of Permascapes Unlimited, Scott Levine. Hey.
Hey, Luke. Thanks for having me.
I hear that there's a great item in the auction that you are responsible for. Tell me about it.
Yeah, so this year we're excited to be able to bring a flagstone patio to the auction as our labor of love. It'll be about 150 square feet. We have a great choice of stone. We're doing a joint donation with Rocky Mountain Stone and Supply, and they've offered either a fairly standard Colorado red or a really beautiful tan and buff with some brown stripes. We'll have samples of both stones at the auction for people to be able to look at and handle. And we're also going to include a built-in fireplace.
Nice. Nice. That sounds like an expensive proposition normally.
It's a little bit of an undertaking.
Yeah.
We've done a few of them. We actually have one that's almost exactly very similar that we did a couple of years back. People can check out pictures of that on our website, www.permascapes.biz, B-I-Z. Really excited about the kind of built-in fire pit option. It's just a lot of fun. Gives you a nice seating area around the fire pit and also gives you a really aesthetic and attractive and easy to maintain fire pit area in the yard. So,
Scott Levine, thank you so much for donating that to the KD&K Labor of Love auction.
You're welcome. It's really a great event. We've had a lot of fun doing it in the past years, and I'm trying to push a few more real big ticket items in there to get people excited, get people there, get people bidding on all the other stuff. We have tons of great donations this year.
One of the things that's interesting about this year's version, Bodie, is the bizarre part of things.
Yeah, definitely. I think we are all really excited for that. Iberian Rugs is going to be decorating the bazaar.
With some of their great rugs.
Yeah, they're great rugs. Nice. Hopefully we'll have some tapestries.
We'll have to get DJ Moo to play some hookah cafe type music.
Yeah, hopefully.
I heard there might be a hookah, but we're not filling it for people.
No. Not during the auction.
Check us out in the alley afterward. No, just kidding. So how does the auction work? People have to sign up, right?
Yeah, just come in the door. We'll have a few people there to sign you up. You'll get a bidder number, and then you can just go around and bid on anything that catches your eye, which will probably be quite a few things this year.
And most of those items also have you don't necessarily have to partake in the auction for each item. You can actually buy each item outright. Is that correct?
Yeah, definitely. All our items have a buy it now price, so you can come in and buy them outright. And then in the bazaar, you can just go in and buy things outright in the bazaar.
One of the things I've been working on for the bazaar are some music packages. KD&K gets excess CDs from a lot of these great releases throughout the year, and I've put together 4 or 5 of them. I'm calling 2 of them the dinosaur packages because it's, you know, Judy Collins, David Crosby, Graham Nash, all the old white guys.
Yeah.
The dinosaurs.
Yep.
But there's a really good blues package. There's a Putumayo package.
Nice.
A couple of them from Brazil and Greece and Africa, and there's also a country package. So, you know, I know that people don't buy CDs like they used to, but these are all brand new CDs, and they're ready for the taking. And believe me, we're going to put a good price on those suckers.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no reason not to buy them.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, Bodie, thanks for your labor on the Labor of Love auction.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You've been working so hard for a while now, and we're about to see the fruits of Bodie's labor. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Bodie. And I also want to take the time to thank those local businesses providing food and drink to the auction. The Carbondale Beer Works, Fat Tie, Pepino's, Marble Distilling, and Roaring Fork Beer Company, all of them stepping up to the plate and helping out your hometown community radio station. And I want to thank again the sponsors of this year's auction, Alpine Bank, A&B Bank, and Isbarian Rugs. Thank you so much for supporting KD&K. Eric Story grew up in Northwest Colorado reading Travis McGee and Louis L'Amour novels by lantern light. And now, 30-some years later, he has written a fast-paced crime thriller set in Grand Junction, Rifle, and Leadville. I spoke with Eric yesterday. Eric Story joins me now. Hi, Eric.
Hi, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. Eric Story, you have a debut novel that's just been published. Congratulations.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, it's called Nothing Short of Dying. It's a crime thriller set in Western Colorado, which is really cool to see local places in a book.
Yeah, especially one that came out from New York. It's pretty exciting.
Yes, it is. How would you describe Nothing Short of Dying for our listeners?
That's the story of a rugged adventurer who comes back to the States after getting out of prison, comes back to this part of the country, and finds out his sister's in trouble. So he goes to rescue her. I guess that's the main plot.
Uh-huh. Well, let's talk about Clyde Barr. That's the person you're talking about. Clyde Barr just had gotten out of prison in Mexico on his way to Yukon because he doesn't like civilization?
Yes. Yeah, he's sick of civilization. He's never really liked it. He's a lot more comfortable around a campfire than he is, you know, doing radio interviews or those type of things.
So Clyde Barr is in some sense yourself.
Yeah, those things, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And as you said, he gets a phone call from his sister around the campfire, as a matter of fact.
True.
One literary critic called Clyde, quote, skilled, loyal, tough, and beautifully broken.
Yeah, he's broken, that's for sure.
What broke Clyde Barr?
Kept going to the third world countries and some of the developing nations and saw how rough life is there. He tried to help, but every time he tried to help in one of those countries, he ended up getting pulled into some nasty conflict, and I think he's just seen too much of it. And then when his sister gets in trouble, and it's kind of the similar situation here, it's enough to really push him to do whatever it takes to get her back.
So he got a call from her at a number he didn't recognize. So he had no idea where she was.
Correct.
And he had to go find her.
Right. So there's a little bit of the mystery search for.
And to do that, he draws on some of his old friends and some of his contacts, some of which may be less than savory.
True. One of them was a cellmate when he was in prison in Mexico, and he's a interesting character, we'll put it that way. He was fun to write. He's a very rough, scary character.
So there's a backstory with Clyde Barr and his sister Jen, and we won't outline that now because we certainly don't want to spoil it.
True. Yeah, you should read it.
You should. And it's a real page turner, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
But I think that draws on a pretty crucial part of Clyde's character, and that's his loyalty to family.
True. Yeah. He'll do whatever it takes to help his sisters, and he did when he was younger, growing up. And then when he comes back, he does it again.
Yeah. The guy just never says, he never quits. Clyde Barr never quits, does he?
I mean, no matter how many times he's knocked down, he just keeps getting back up.
Or shot.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, it was almost like I found myself thinking of Achilles.
Uh-huh.
You know, who rampages across the battlefield, seemingly untouched by anything.
Right.
And I kind of got that sense. I mean, he dispatched, at least 20 people in a couple of those scenes.
Yeah, probably the first 30 pages of the book, I think. There's that many people out.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's kind of what he is. He's one of those traditional heroes that even follows the same archetype as a lot of those wandering tough heroes like Achilles and some of the old Ronins and the knight errants, you know, like I think he mentions that a couple times, some of his, the other knights that he would, that would be impressed by what he was doing, he thought.
You know, I'm a big fan of C.J. Box, and C.J. Box kind of carved out his territory up in Wyoming and made it pretty exotic.
Uh-huh.
You know, I'm thinking of Nate Romanowski, for instance. I didn't see any comparable figure yet in your book, but I'm wondering if that was sort of a conscious thing to set the novel in a there's nobody else writing detective novels in Western Colorado.
True. Yeah, and that's what I wanted. There's not very many at all in the Intermountain West, really. Wyoming, there's, you know, C.J. Box and Craig Johnson. But between the Rockies and the Sierras, there's all this space that you could put a character in and have him do a lot of things, but nobody writes about it. And it's some of my favorite country. You know, I grew up in this area. There's so much room for them to move and so many beautiful things to write about.
I was struck by the fact that the Joe Pickett novels by C.J. Box. Joe Pickett's pretty much a Boy Scout, but I wouldn't call Clyde Barr a Boy Scout.
No, he's kind of the rougher anti-hero. He's more, in the Pickett ones, he's more like Nate than he would be Joe.
Yeah, yeah, but not quite that spiritual edge that Nate.
No, and he doesn't falcon. He doesn't even like birds. So,
so you were quoted as saying there was a giant block of gross granite that I had to chip at to get Clyde. What did you mean by that?
Well, he started. I was a huge fan growing up of Travis McGee books, and I wanted kind of a Western Travis McGee, and I started, I don't know, 8 years ago writing stuff with a similar character, but it took actually all those years until about 4 years ago before I had a Clyde character that he is now. It took a lot of rewrites. I don't know, 50 or so total rewrites before we
50 rewrites.
Yeah, before I had this Clyde.
This is your first, but I noticed that you've already got one or two more in the can. Is that right?
One in the can, yeah. Now, yeah. That we're in the midst of edits that I'm supposed to be doing right now. So.
Well, you've mentioned you're growing up just a little bit already, but I want to dive into that a little bit deeper. You grew up in Rangeley.
True, yes.
Wow, I've never met anybody that grew up in Rangeley. There must be just 1,000 people that can say that.
Yeah, there's not very many.
Not very many. Tell me about Rangeley. How did that shape you as a person and as a writer?
Definitely made me a writer.
How so?
Because there was nothing else to do other than go outside and roam. There's 50 miles of public land in every direction, but there's nothing in town. So it's either go out and play or stay at home and read. My parents were big readers. I haunted the library. The librarians are like ants to me. They all know my name still. So that much reading and that much spending out time time outside thinking about what I was reading, I think, made me a writer.
And what you were reading was genre fiction?
Yeah, but all pretty genres. Yeah. I started mostly with sci-fi and fantasy.
Oh, really?
Huh. My dad always read Westerns. My mom always read mysteries. So they were laying around, too, and I picked those up. So
one summer you read every Louis L'Amour book?
Yes, I did.
How about that?
60-something books.
How about that? And I also read that you spent a lot of time reading by lantern light. In a cabin in the Flat Tops? Is that where that was?
Yeah. When I was a lot younger, my parents had a friend that had a cabin grandfathered into the Flat Tops Wilderness. So we'd ride or hike up in there and stay most of the summer. That's actually where I learned to ride a horse before I learned to ride a bike.
How about that?
Yeah. And then later, we took control of my great-grandfather's homestead up Piance Creek between Rifle and Meeker. And then we spent every summer up there.
And so growing up in Rangeley, did you run across a teacher that encouraged this tendency to read and write? How did the writing bug bite you?
I always kind of wrote, kept journals, but I was more of a reader than anything until there's a couple teachers in high school that pushed me to keep reading and try to write something. And then college, they had actually in Colorado Mountain College in Leadville.
Oh, really?
Mr. Cummings, who's no longer with us, but he said, you have to start selling some of these stories. And he didn't, it wasn't a question. He told me I had to. So I went, and that's where I really started, I think.
Huh. So how did you do that? How did you start publishing your stories? How did you start getting out there? Did you start with websites? Did you?
No, I started, that was so long ago, I started with those old novel and short story publication books, I guess. It had lists of places that were buying short stories. And then later, yeah, there's a website called Duotrope that has all the places that buy short stories.
Huh.
And that's where I went to sell them.
Huh. What's that called?
Duotrope.
Duotrope.
Mm-hmm.
Huh. I'll have to check that out. Duotrope. Huh. And I noticed that like every other budding author, had your share of rejections.
Oh, yeah, plenty. I stopped counting at 50. My wife said there was 60-something. That was just for agents.
But then one day you got a call from England. Tell me about that.
Yeah, that was a very interesting day just because I'd sent it to everyone that I could think of and then got rejected from every New York person that I sent to and thought, well, maybe let's try as a last resort somebody that'll never, you know, that's going to say no, but it's a huge agent and he represents a character or a writer that has a character similar to mine. So I just gave it a shot and I had to send it. Most agents, you send email now, and he didn't. He wanted actual post. So I had to send it with our last $9 by post as a last resort. And I still thought that phone call would never come. So when it did, and it was Darley Anderson from London saying, I kind of like this, so I want to read the rest of the book. I dropped the phone. My wife thought it was so horrible. You know, somebody has cancer call. It was a life changer.
Huh. So he read it. He liked it. What happened then?
Then he took me on as a client and then started shipping or trying to sell it. And that it took a long time, too, even though he's one of the best agents in the world. It was hard to sell at first, too, until he found this brilliant editor in New York who helped me work it to where it is now. It was a lot different even when we were trying to sell it the first time.
Tell me about that process, working with your editor. Did you at any point along the process, along the way, find it necessary to say, I'm not going to do that? That's going to compromise my story. Or did you take everything he said to heart?
Almost everything he said, yeah. And the things that I didn't want to change were really minute because it's a commercial book. It's commercial fiction. So I kind of thought of him more as like an Olympic coach. He's helping me get better. It was more of a learning process than it was a battle. Some writers do have that mentality when they work with their agent, like this is constant war. But I look at it more as a coach, athlete type of situation.
Oh, well, that makes sense, especially since you're a newbie, you know.
Yeah.
Those people have more experience in the field than you, for sure.
Yeah, and he's published 80 bestsellers, so I really can't, or he's edited 80 bestsellers, so I really can't argue with him much.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. But I guess maybe after you have five of them under your belt, you can say, oh, I'm not going to do that.
Right.
Especially if they sell. How long has it been out, the book?
Since August.
August.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and are the sales figures encouraging?
I haven't checked.
Oh, you haven't even checked?
I don't keep track.
How about that?
I'm trying to work on this next one so much that it would be distracting.
So did you get an advance against future royalties? Is that the way it worked?
For two books, yeah.
For two books.
Mm-hmm.
I see. So after two books, you can move elsewhere if you want.
Right.
Uh-huh. Or if they want. Or
yeah.
Demand.
And they have first right of refusal on the third. If they want it, they can get it. But
huh.
And I love working with Rick, this editor, so I wouldn't mind if they take the third one.
So is it the classic story of you got that advance and you were able to quit your day job, which I understand you had a lot of day jobs over the years.
Yeah, just about everything.
Uh-huh, including mushing dogs up in Wyoming.
Yep, and horseback tours and steamboat and janitor, truck driver, bartender, all, you know, the normal blue collar, mostly seasonal jobs.
Yeah. Yeah. Huh.
And I didn't, it wasn't enough to quit my day job, but I still work seasonally.
Do you?
But it was enough for us to move. We finally moved out of Rangeley to Grand Junction, the big city, you know,
right,
living it up.
Right. So you moved from Rangeley to Grand Junction. How about that? Huh. Well, I love the acknowledgments in your book. I really want to point this out to some of our listeners here. First of all, you thank your parents for teaching you to love reading and to work hard. How cool is that?
It's true.
You also mentioned a couple of the teachers along the way in your acknowledgments, and you said, I promised you'd be mentioned in here if this ever happened, and I didn't forget. Gotta love that. And then also your wife and your daughters, of course. But here's the kicker, at least from my perspective. To readers everywhere, you are a dwindling and unique breed, and I thank you for trading money and time to enjoy books when there are so many other things competing for your attention.
Yeah, it's very true nowadays.
Huh. Do you have a Kindle?
I do.
You do?
Because my wife encouraged me to get one because we had a smaller house and we were running out of room for physical books and I couldn't stop buying them. So she bought me a Kindle for Christmas and said, hey, you can put hundreds of them on here and it doesn't take up any space.
Nice. How about that? Well, you know, I really have to hand it to you for keeping your head screwed on right and acknowledging the people in your life that, you know, brought you to this point. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, you can't do it on your own.
Yeah. Well, I bet your wife was a big part of that.
Huge. That's why the book's dedicated to her.
Uh-huh.
For that reason. She's actually with me today through with all this touring. She's been with me on the whole tour because the book would have never been written without her.
Uh-huh. Where else are you touring?
Well, we had toured Phoenix, Dallas, New Orleans. Okay, I can't remember where else we went.
Wow. That's
Denver, Fort Collins and Boulder.
That's really exciting.
Yeah.
Get to go to those places. Now, when you tour, you're giving readings, public readings?
Readings and a little bit of a speech and then question and answer and then some signings.
Well, that tour brings you to the Rifle Branch Library tonight at 6 p.m. So our listeners have a chance to get a look at your book and hear kind of what it's about.
Yeah, I'll explain how it came to be and who Clyde is for those that haven't read it. Hopefully you have, but either way, come on down.
Yeah, that's great. Well, Eric Story, I want to thank you for joining us here at KDNK, and best of luck to you.
All right, thank you very much.
Eric Story with Nothing Short of Dying. And again, that reading tonight at the Rifle Library starts at 6. Well, stay with us. Christine Lavin is up next. Here is one of Christine's signature songs.
Okay, everybody, it's time for a little sing-along, but just for you guys out there, all right? This is called Sensitive New Age Guys, and wherever you are right now, riding in your car or lying on the beach with your Walkman on, please sing along on this song. It'll help you with your male bonding kind of thing. And to help you, I've rounded up every sensitive guy I could find in New York City tonight. So you just sing along with them, please, don't be shy. Who like to talk about their feelings?
Sensitive New Age guys.
Who's into crystals, into healing?
Sensitive New Age guys.
Who like to dress like Richard Simmons?
Sensitive New Age guys.
Who are hard to tell from women?
Sensitive New Age guys.
Who like to cry at weddings? Who think Rambo upsetting? Who tapes 30-something on their VCRs? Who's got child on board stickers on their cars? Ooh. Ooh. Whose last names are hyphenated?
Sensitive New Age guys.
Who love three men and a baby, a movie I hated?
Sensitive New Age guys.
Consciousness is constantly raising.
Sensitive New Age guys.
Yet whose tax-free income is amazing.
Sensitive New Age guys.
Who thinks that red meat is disgusting? Who's into UFOs, channeling, and dusting? Who believes us when we say we've got premenstrual syndrome? Who doesn't know who plays in the Seattle Kingdom? Lots of guys don't know who plays in the Seattle Kingdom. Guys not into brutal, violent contact sports. Why? Let's ask these sensitive guys right here. Hey, guys. Do you know who plays in the Seattle Kingdom?
Will Ackerman. Come on, sucker.
Oh, good answer, good answer. Who likes music that's repetitious?
Sensitive new age guys.
Who likes music that's repetitious?
Sensitive new age guys.
Who's concerned about your orgasm? Hey, wait a minute, wait a minute. You guys said you'd help me out on this song.
Yeah.
What's going on?
Well, we're sensitive, Christine.
But not that sensitive.
Well, I guess it's more important that they have them.
Sensitive new age guys.
Who carries the baby on his back? Who thinks Shirley MacLaine is on the inside track? Who always sings on sing-alongs, even when they can't stand stupid sing-along songs? Yes, I could tell a lot of you guys out there really hated this song. Not all of you sang, but a lot of you did because it was a sing-along and you didn't want to hurt my feelings.
Didn't want to hurt your feelings.
Because you know what that's like.
Stupid.
Because you've had your feelings hurt so many times because you're so sensitive.
And
yes,
stupid.
You're sensitive.
That was Sensitive New Age Guy from Christine Lavin's 1990 album. Wow, how about that? 1990. Called Attainable Love. Christine has nurtured a nearly four-decade career as a singer-songwriter, known for her humor and her deft portrayals of relationships. Christine is still recording and touring, and that includes a stop next Thursday, December 8th, at Steve's Guitars. I spoke with Christine last Tuesday and found that she has not lost her sense of humor, despite Donald Trump and the vicissitudes of age.
Now, you're playing Swallow Hill, aren't you?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I'll bet you've been to Swallow Hill a few times.
Oh, yeah. We're going to have a knitting circle before that show. A local knit shop is going to show up, and we're going to have knitters. Because in Denver, the knit shop owner contacted me at my website and asked me if I was still doing knitting circles. I said, I sure will if you'll be there. So she's going to co-host it with me.
Well, I know knitting circles are a pretty popular thing around here, so I will.
Oh, well, you know
we'll
what?
Get the
we'll
word
talk
out.
About it. Yeah, we'll tell people come an hour early and bring your knitting. And you know what?
Yes.
I do it intermission. We try to be full service performers. So we'll knit before the show, but during intermission, I teach people how to fold napkins in fancy ways, like Downton Abbey, but I also learn some new folds for Christmas.
Well,
so
Chris,
if they're going to have a nice Christmas party, they can come and up their skills of napkin folding.
Christine Lavin, you still have a sense of humor, don't you?
This isn't funny. I take this very seriously.
Rock and roll, baby.
No, I don't know why, but people love napkin folding. And it's I've also learned that it sort of eats into my merch sales, because people are way too interested in napkins. In fact, I think people now are coming to the show for the napkin folding and staying for the concert, but really they're there for the napkin folding.
So is that like folding origami? No.
It's somewhat like that, but it's, you know, they're cloth napkins, and they're 20 by 20 inches, and there's really a lot you can do.
Like
and
what?
It's very,
tell me.
It's very calming. It's like knitting. There's something about it that's very calming. And it's nice because, you know, once you see a fancy napkin, it means a good dinner's coming.
Well, there's that. And I love the idea of knitting. I mean, I still have a sweater that my grandmother knitted for me. Now, I can't it fit in it anymore, but I still have it.
Oh, but that's so nice. You know, when I lived in New York, I'm not living there now. I'm living upstate helping out with the care of my mom, who's 97. But I lived in a fancy building with a doorman and an elevator operator. And the elevator operator told me, he was from Albania, that his mother knitted all their clothes. And when they outgrew them, she unraveled them and knit them again in bigger sizes.
Wow.
Isn't that something? And you want to know what he always wanted? He always wanted store-bought clothes. He always thought his hand-knitted stuff was not as nice And of course, now as an older man, he realizes how lucky he was. He had custom-made clothing.
Yes.
His mother would make him one size and then unravel and make it a bigger size when he grew.
Well,
so sweet.
Did your mother knit for you, Christine?
No. My mom's a crocheter, but she has 9 children. And so she was just lucky to, you know, keep us all, you know, clean and dressed. That was about as much as she could do for 9 kids.
So you had 8 siblings.
Yes.
Wow. Huh. Do you think that affected
you?
I only had 1 sibling. I have 1 sibling. But do you think that might have put you on the path that you're on, maybe?
Well, one thing about coming from a big family, people always say, what's it like? Well, you don't have anything to compare it to. It's your only experience. But over the years as a performer, I'm always teaming up with other musicians. I love bringing other people on stage. And I think it's because I'm comfortable being in a group, and I'm not that comfortable being alone on stage.
Well, I could see one upside of a big family is there's certainly a lot to observe and a lot to take in, a lot of content.
Yeah. The thing is, though, it's also there's a lot of opinions and a lot of squabbling and a lot of quarreling. And some of it gets better with age and some of it grows more intense with age. So but I think for older parents, if you've had a big family, there's a good chance that you'll be taken well care of in your old age because you've had enough children to make sure you had enough good ones.
Well, now, did the music bug bite you as a child, or did that come later?
You know what? I actually started on the piano when I was 7 years old, but I had a terrible, crazy teacher who had a long pencil who would crack my knuckles whenever I would play the wrong note.
Oh.
And it was horrible. I would walk home crying after every lesson. My knuckles would be red and sore. And eventually my mom let me quit lessons after 2 years because one of the teachers at the school where we live, we grew up at a military school, her name was Mrs. Bajan. She was in her 60s, and she started taking piano lessons from the same teacher. And when she cracked her knuckles, Mrs. Bajan stood up, grabbed the pencil, broke it in two, threw it in the teacher's face, walked out, and that was the end of her piano lesson. And because we had party lines back then, word spread like wildfire all around town that Mrs. Bajan destroyed the demon pencil. And so all the parents started to believe the children about how they were getting hit by this teacher. So it was about 5 years later that I started playing guitar because I watched lessons on public TV. And it didn't take me long to figure out that if I played along with the lady on the TV, if I played it wrong, she couldn't hit me through the TV set.
Did you write a song about that?
Well, you know what? Actually, I did. Because I'm friends with Julie Gold, who wrote the song From a Distance, the Bette Midler song. And, you know, from a distance, the world looks blue and green. And so she has always believed that that is a magic piano that she wrote that song on. So over the past 2 years, she's asked her friend to sit at her magic piano for an hour at a time and see if they can get a song out of it. And I kept turning her down because of my history with piano that she didn't know. I didn't want to stir up those horrible feelings of getting whacked by that demon pencil. But finally, she wore me down, and I sat at the piano, and I wrote a song about the horrible piano teacher and how those. When I think about it, I could really thank her now because if it wasn't for her whacking me in the knuckles with a pencil at a piano, I might not have taken up guitar.
So that was the key moment, taking up the guitar.
Yeah, and I met my guitar teacher 26 years later when she came to a show in San Francisco that I was performing, and they put my picture in the paper and said I learned how to play guitar when I was 12 watching lessons on public TV. And she looked at the picture, estimated my age, figured out what year that was, and came to the show with her business card. And on the back she wrote, "Did I teach you how to play guitar?" And I was like, "Oh, my God, my guitar teacher's in the audience." And it was so funny. It was a Poor Bitch and Babe show. So there was Sally Fingerette, Megan McDonough, and Patty Larkin all on stage with me. who are all much more accomplished musicians than I am. And during intermission, I got to meet Laura Weber. That's the name of the guitar teacher from PBS. And she said, "Do you make up for all my live students who never practiced? And the best part is, you're the best guitarist on stage." And the truth is, I was the least of the guitarists, but she was so proud. She thought I was the best.
Four Bitchin' Babes. Wow, that there's a blast from the past. Your first, you guys
well, you
got.
Know, they're still out there.
Are you still? That was my question. You still tour as Four Bitchin' Babes, huh?
No, I don't. I left the group in 1997
because
it started not to be fun for me, and you know, and I knew that somebody else could take my place, and it would bring the fun back. And so there's been a, you know, rotating crop of babes who've been in the show. I mean, Janis Ian was a babe. Mary Travers, the late, great Mary Travers of Peter, Paul, and Mary, she was a babe. Even Dave Van Ronk was a babe. but that was a very short stint.
Well, I read somewhere that it was Dave Van Ronk that convinced you to move to New York City. Is that right?
It was, yeah. I met him in 1977 at the Cafe Lena in Saratoga Springs. I was a waitress and a bread baker, and he was traveling through from Montreal, and Lena said, "Play him a song." So I played him a song, and he said, "You should come to New York." And I said, it was the same night that Don McLean's manager saw me play, and he said, gave me his card, and he said, "You know, you should learn how to play guitar better, and when you do, come to New York, and I can help you." So when Dave said, "Come to New York," I said, "Well, I will, but first I have to learn how to play guitar better." And he said, "I'm a teacher. I'll teach you." So I was like, okay, that's decision is made. And 2 weeks later, I was living in New York.
So that was in the 80s, in the 70s? When was that?
In the 70s, 1977. I worked as a temp for 8 years in New York City. I never, you know, there's no dignity in starving. And I always tell musicians, never take handouts, never let people pay for this and that and this and that, because there's always a much steeper price to pay if you allow other people to take care of you and you, you know, just are being this artist, you know, this starving artist. There's no dignity in that, because you'll end up paying one way or the other, and it's going to be much worse. So I always worked. I always had jobs. And I quit my last day job in 1984 when I was at Bellevue Hospital. And I was making $25,000 a year. I had a month's paid vacation and health insurance and dental insurance. And my first year as a folk singer, I made $6,000 and had no insurance, but I was way happier.
Huh. Tell me about late 70s, early 80s folk scene in New York City. I'm thinking what? That would be Suzanne Vega. Who else was involved?
Oh, yeah. Suzanne Vega, Jack Hardy, John Gorka, Cliff Eberhart, Nancy Griffith. Then eventually Michelle Schacht was part of it, Tracy Chapman. So many people. Lyle Lovett. A lot of it had to do with the Fast Folk Musical magazine. And I worked as a production coordinator for the magazine. You know, we all worked for free, and it was very ambitious. It was Jack Hardy's project, where we'd put out a magazine every month, and it would have about 16 or 18 songs on it, and the inside, and it was a vinyl record, and inside would be a you know, hand-printed magazine with all the lyrics and short bios on all the artists, and it was available for $2 an issue. Started in 1982. Suzanne Vega's on the very first one, so is Eric Franzen, Frank Christian, the late Frank Christian, Dave Van Ronk, the late Dave Van Ronk is on it. And after about the first 8 or 10 issues, the question became that we had to raise the price of the issue, because people thought a record for $2 with a magazine inside couldn't be good because it was only $2. So we raised it to $4. And then another year later, Jack Hardy thought, oh, you know what, people, we have artists who want to do covers now for the magazine, and people want to write for it, and it's costing more money to go in the recording studio. So maybe we should raise it above $4. And people were like, oh, no, no, we can't do that. Nobody will be able to afford it because we were all poor. And by the way, I'm poor again now. But the funny part was Jack Hardy did a survey when they mailed out the next issue of the magazine, when it was $4 an issue. They asked the people to fill out the survey and send it back. And it was a smack upside the head when they discovered that the average income back in 1984 of the person who was subscribing to Fast Folk, the average income was $75,000 a year. And we thought they couldn't afford more than $4 an issue.
Oh, wow. How about that? So you were misreading that audience.
The issue skyrocketed $10 an issue at some point. Huh. But the thing is, I worked so hard on the ones that I produced because I feel this is a permanent record of what is going on here. And years later, the Smithsonian bought up the entire catalog. And it made me so glad that I took it so seriously because my name is on it. I can't remember how many I produced, maybe 3 or 4 issues where I made all the decisions on who got on it. And I never wanted to have even like a B-plus song. I wanted every song to be A++. And now anybody can go to the Smithsonian Folkways, and they can buy individual tracks. They don't even have to buy the whole issue. And you can do it all digitally. And it's really a great document for that early stretch of the 1980s of what was being done in folk music in New York. And then it branched to Boston, to Saratoga Springs, Philadelphia, Washington, D.C. And it's stuff that by a lot of songwriters who never got well known but were very good songwriters and have, like one guy, Hugh Blumenfeld, he's now a doctor. He's a pediatrician, and he's very well respected and very popular with his patients in Connecticut. And he's one of the people who recorded a number of songs on Fast Folk that were really wonderful songs, and I'm thrilled that his stuff is preserved that way.
Well, there must have been something going on there, and then because a lot of those names you just listed are still recording and touring. Well, I'm thinking that comedians and folk singers are going to profit from a Donald Trump presidency.
Well, you know, I think it's going to be such a disastrous presidency. I mean, you know, this new guy, he's just hired a Hollywood guy who has no experience in government. That's his the treasurer. And he's hired this, you know, he's hiring, so far, all the women he's hired have one thing in common. They're good looking.
Yeah.
Is that a surprise? Nikki Haley, God bless her, from South Carolina, a lovely woman, a smart woman, zero experience in international affairs. So, yeah, let's put her in the UN. Let's put her on a learning curve. You know, really, you know that there's got to be other people who are more qualified for the job. Maybe not as pretty as she is, but I don't think looks should be part of it. And I can feel my blood pressure rising now. Oops. Don't get me started.
All right. Well, let's go to another subject that may or may not raise your blood pressure. I know that in the past it might have, and that is relationships. You're known for the relationship song. And I'm wondering, as an older woman, if that still matters. Is that still something that you're writing about?
Oh, yeah. You know what? The love of my life, his name is Maury. In fact, the reason I spent so much time in Colorado is because he had a house in Aspen. And his next-door neighbor was Jack Nicholson. But, you know, that's no big deal in Aspen. He died in January 2013. And to this day, my most requested song is The Kind of Love You Never Recover From. And I wrote that about him. Huh. And I have not been able to sing it since he died. Uh-huh. But there is a song that I do, and it's written by Daniel Keener, who's on the McCabe's record. It's called Under the Table, and it's the story, true story, of his grandfather, Isaac. And you know what I can do? When I get home in a couple hours, I can email you the recording, an MP3, or I might even have a wave of it, of that song. from the latest record by Daniel.
I love that.
Under the Table, because I'm telling you, it has such an effect on audiences because it's about the unrequited longings of a grandfather. And because I am older, I'm 64, and a lot of people who come to the shows are in their 50s and 60s, and sometimes older and sometimes much younger. But that song, Under the Table, about Grandfather Isaac and this woman who was a friend of the family named Ray, it brings the audience to the still point where when the song is over, it's really hard to read the audience after that song because I know that it stirs up trouble. I got an email from a woman who said to me, who wrote to me, I hope I never have to hear that song about Grandfather Isaac and Aunt Ray again because there was an Aunt Ray in our family and it was not a pretty picture. Please never sing that song again.
No.
And I wrote back to her and I said, I'm sorry that the song upset you, but I think that it's a beautiful, heartfelt, and a true story. And I think that as we get older, it's good for older people to know that there are songs that are written about things that they may have felt or thought but have never talked about. And I find it really interesting. Sometimes after I sing that song, I ask, are there any grandfathers in the house? And these hands will shoot up and I'll say, oh, Grandpa, you fascinate me. But then I see the grandmother sitting with them, and they're not so pleased about this. So.
Oh, yeah, well, you know.
But believe me, and I have a new song I'll be doing because I'm going to be trying it out this weekend in Detroit. It's called RSVP NYC, and it's about being invited to a birthday party. I was invited to a birthday party a couple weeks ago when I was in New York by this very successful Broadway composer. And he told me, he does it every year, you're going to love it, have a great group of people. Give me the name of the bar, come after 9 o'clock. So a week later is the party, and I forgot what time it started, but I knew a friend was going, so I texted her. I said, what time does that thing start? And she said, I hope. Nice to see you. Bye-bye. So I said, what time does the party start? And she said, we're texting, and she said, 6:30. You can't be late. I said, 6:30? I remember, he said, later, you could come by any time. There was no time restriction. She goes, no, it's got to be 6:30. So I went back to my emails, and sure enough, he said, come at 9, after 9, that's when it starts at the bar. And that's when I discovered there were two parties. It was a 6:30 sit-down dinner in a fancy restaurant, and then there was the 9 o'clock party afterwards for everybody, not just the special people who got the dinner. So guess what? I didn't go. Because it was like an A-list and a B-list.
Oh.
So I've written a song about it because, you know, I think that that's, again, something that we all go through.
Sure.
And, you know, at all different ages, here I am in my 60s having my nose out of joint because I realize I'm on this guy's B-list. But he's not going to be happy when he hears the song.
Oh.
And I'm sure someday he will.
Well, you know, that's in your job description, isn't it? Cause a little trouble, stir the pot a little bit.
That's right. Woody Guthrie himself said it. The job of the folk singer is to comfort the disturbed and disturb the comfortable.
Exactly.
So I tell people, you know, I have a couple of gun songs people really, really hate. Oh, my God, the emails I get. And I write back to them. I tell them what Woody Guthrie said. I said, you know, I'm disturbing you, your comfortable life, and I'm just doing my job.
What will audiences see at Steve's Guitars on Thursday?
Well, you know what? They're going to see a lot of funny stuff. But both Don White and I do some serious. And I think it's almost like you have to. For me, as a performer, a real light bulb moment was when I saw Steve Goodman play. And he did this hilarious song about women who love men, who love women, who love men. Something like that. It was just very, yeah, very funny. People just laughing and laughing. And then the next song he did was called My Old Man. Mm. And people were just weeping, not crying. They were weeping.
Yeah.
And I was standing in the back of the room. It was a standing room only. And I thought, holy mother of God. He went from one extreme to the other. Somehow it worked. And I didn't even know you were allowed to do that. And I realized it's important to do that in shows because people can laugh and laugh, but you got to give them a break. And how do you know something's really funny until you contrast it with something that's really sad? And life is full of, you know, all of these moments, these bits of hilarity and these heart-wrenching moments of grief. And it's all reflected in the music that's being written. It's not reflected in the music you hear mostly on the radio for pop radio or, you know, I mean, I used to subscribe to Billboard and all that, and it's like you look now at the top 10 songs, and they each have 10 writers on it, and there's no melody, and there's no point of view, but it's just like jazz. There will always be a folk audience, always be people who want to hear the truth.
So some old songs, some new songs, some happy songs, some sad songs, probably a few stories,
yep,
in there.
But also knitting before and napkin folding during intermission.
Okay.
And I also, I know that there's somebody listening who is like a champion napkin folder because somebody will always come who knows a million more folds than I do, and I love it, and I have them teach everybody something. So if you are a secret champion napkin folder, which I think could be an event in the Olympics, I'm not sure, but I'm hoping someday. Please come, and I have these beautiful damask napkins that we'll be using, the real nice ones. And it'll be very genteel and civilized, and your next dinner party will be elevated.
That's Christine Levin. And if you, as she said, want to knit with Christine, show up about an hour before the show next Thursday at Steve's Guitars, and you can do some knitting with Christine Levin.